We are in chapter 16, and in the middle of that discussion of the various characters and symbols that are found in the 16th chapter. There are a lot of them in this particular chapter. In fact, we've got about four or five on another slide to finish up our study. We're at now the 12th verse of our explanations concerning these various symbols. We are to the river Euphrates, which is the third one down in the second column, if you're looking up on the board, the river Euphrates. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And of course, this is a vision. And I think it can be said that though Euphrates is a physical river, and perhaps there is some physical significance with regard to the fulfillment of the prophecies that we'll discuss for a few moments, it's not surprising that the river Euphrates would come up because of the imagery that is established throughout the Old Testament as well as the New about that particular river. I took the time to put a map up with regard to our present, the present location. It begins up in northern Turkey and goes down into the Red Sea. This river Euphrates was a very large and very significant river that ran through the western part of Asia, about 1,800 miles long, and entering into the Persian Gulf at its base. You'll remember that the first time that the river Euphrates is mentioned in Scripture is that it was one of the significant rivers that that boundaried the Garden of Eden, from whence the water supply came there. It was a very significant boundary and landmark to the east. You know, the kind of similar imagery that we might come across in America is the Gateway Arch at St. Louis. I had an opportunity to travel to St. Louis while in high school one time on a trip, and we got to go up in the Gateway Arch and look out over it. But that's called the Gateway to the West, and because it's right there on the banks of the Mississippi River. And the Mississippi River in our country is a pretty significant divider in our history as well as geographically, and that certainly is the case with regard to the Euphrates itself. The drying up of this, notice verse 12, the sixth angel poured out his bowl in the great river Euphrates. Its water was dried up so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. And so there is this indication that the kings of the east would come to battle. And we're talking again about the defeat of the beast, the defeat of the dragon, the defeat of the minor prophet, which again, if you take that late date, which we have been taking as the basis, the predisposition of our study, it would have reference to the Empire of Rome, that this attack would be from the east. And so the drying up of the river, that boundary, would allow for an easier passage from the east to the west. So if there's any significance with regard to that, actually, that idea that the kings were coming from the east and that God made smooth their path to come and to bring about this end of this evil oppression would be something that would be significant. So after being decayed from within by natural disasters, moral decay, we've talked about this with regard to the empire, the defense from outside ultimately brought that empire to an end. Invaders such as the Parthians, they came from the east to attack the eastern front of the Roman Empire. So that's, again, the river Euphrates. Now, if we go on, and we'll talk about a few things because these are all tied together in this section, but if you have any questions or comments you want to make, you're to feel free to bring them up. But the next one is the kings from the east. You'll notice the description given. The kings of the east might be prepared. I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet. They are the spirits of demons working signs which go out to the kings of the earth, the whole world, to gather them to battle. The battle of that great day of God Almighty. And they were gathered together, notice verse 16, to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. So we've got this great battle, and you've heard of it many, many times, the Battle of Armageddon. And we have the constituent elements of this battle coming together in the description that is given in this text. We'll talk a little bit more about Armageddon. In fact, we'll spend probably more there than anywhere else in our study today. But I do want to note the kings of the east is a is a force, and in this occasion we'll see used by God to defeat evil and oppressive powers that we're talking about in positions of power and in control of the world and the thinking of the world at this particular time. This Battle of Armageddon is a spiritual and a symbolic conflict. And we don't want to forget that. When you start looking for literal battles to describe what is going to happen, certainly the literalism of the premillennialists that we'll talk about in a moment when we talk about the battle itself is not something that will be possible utilizing the language of the apocalypse. In other words, how it is described is sufficiently fantastical or grandiose or metaphorical in its description as to where it cannot be literally possible. We've already seen some things like this when you, for example, talk about, I think in chapter 14, the grapes being coming out of the winepress of the wrath of God and going into the valley and being 200 miles, I forget what the furlongs are, but equaling 200 miles up to the depth, blood up to the depth of the bridles of the horses. I sometimes hesitate to say hyperbole in the sense of overstating the case, but hyperbolic language is the language of the apocalypse. It's that idea of exaggeration to describe in these physical terms the nature of God's judgment against the ungodly, and that's certainly the case here. But we do note, if we were to use that late date as our premise, and the empire of Rome as being the evil oppressor in this case, that the Roman Empire was unable to maintain its defense against the Parthians and others from the east, and the attack was from the east historically as well. So we'll make note of that. The kings from the east, in verse 12, is that force used by God to defeat that empire. And then we get to the three unclean spirits in verse 13. This is an interesting a description that is given, emanating from the mouths of God's enemies. So here's the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. We're well familiar with these characters, these three. The dragon being Satan. You've got the beast of the earth, having reference to this physical kingdom or this secular power that has control over the world. And then the minor prophet or the beast from the sea that utilizes this concept of lies and wonders to confuse the people and deceive them into worshiping the beast. And we talked about emperor worship again, utilizing that construct of the Roman Empire. So these three unclean spirits, we are told in verse 13, they were like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon. Why frogs? That's almost a nonsensical, almost a cartoonish thought to us. But I do want you to remember that frogs were considered somewhat loathsome by the Jew. And so as a part of the understanding and nature of the Christian heritage, it would not be surprising that frogs, as being something loathsome or something that is unclean, would be used to symbolize these three spirits, these three demonic or evil spirits that are mentioned here in this particular text. In appearance, the plagues of Egypt would be that example that we would utilize, as we have a number of times, in paralleling that with the bowls of wrath. As those frogs entered into the land of Egypt, and they were truly a loathsome thing to the Egyptians as a result of their existence and the numbers that were in the land. But these evil spirits, like frogs, use signs and lies to persuade the kings of the earth to unite with Rome. Again, we're using the same kind of idea with regard to what the dragon, what the beast, what the false prophet are doing, the methodologies that they use to try to bring everyone under their umbrella. And you can certainly see that not only with the Empire of Rome, but in previous world empires that we have seen with regard to the Babylonians, Assyrians, then the Persians, the Alexandrian Empire. The same kind of thing was happening, where you have this great broad empire and all of these puppet kings that were following the behest of the central power and this political hegemony that existed for these centuries. This is how it's done. And a big part of the success of the empire in one section or certain time period with regard to the Roman Empire was the empire worship, the emperor worship, excuse me, that took place, and these signs and lies. We might refer to it today as propaganda. And of course, there are countries that are guilty, perhaps even our own, of propaganda. You know, if we're fighting for the emperor, then what we are doing must be a righteous battle. Well, that's, of course, a lie, and it's a lie that is established. But that's would be the rallying cry of those who would come to battle for Rome. Harkrider, in his commentary, he takes that late view. He said that Caesar worship was a vain system of religion and destined to failure because the conflict that exists here is like all, like the Elijah on Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal, like the inhabitants of Canaan as the Israelites came and just wiped them out almost. They should have wiped them out entirely according to God's commands, but didn't. But that is that when you've got this system of government that is inclusive of idolatry and ungodliness, it will be judged by the Almighty God of heaven, and that conflict is doomed on the part of those who are opposed to Jehovah. And that's really the picture that we're getting. When we get into the discussion of the 17th chapter, which we really get in deep, it's going to take some study on our part to get through and have a decent understanding of what Romans chapter 17 is fully teaching us. But it is borne out with regard to the judgment of the great harlot on that beast. And the fact that ultimately, whenever you ally yourself as an enemy of God, no matter how strong the forces that you marshal, no matter how involved or total the commitment of these groups, ultimately it ends in failure for you because you are fighting against God. All right? So we'll get to the dragon beast, false prophet, and then I'll give you a chance for any comments or questions you might have, because those three, we know who they are. We've already identified them in previous chapters. The dragon has reference to Satan. So these deceptions and lies are coming from the mouth of Satan through the guise of these evil spirits. We have identified the beast as the Roman Empire fronted by the emperor, if we're going to use, again, that late date as our construct. And then finally, the false prophet, also referred to as the beast from the earth, is false religion, which in the case of Rome would be emperor worship. Now, with that in mind, they all come together, and we're told, if you'll notice, there in chapter 16 and verse 16, they come together, gathered together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. And initially, I don't care who you are, if you are from America at least, there may be some others where the premillennial theory is more obscure, but if you have heard Armageddon, you want to know about the Battle of Armageddon. That's the big one, and that's the bad one, and what's going to happen, and when is it going to happen? And of course, primarily that kind of view that, oh, something's coming, and that something's going to be bad, and there are going to be world battles going on, and that this kind of idea that it's yet future is embraced by many because the premillennial view is something that has gained ascendancy among the evangelicals. And I do want to make this note. There's premillennial thinking. Premillennialism, because some of you may not be completely aware of it, but premillennialism is the doctrine that there will be a rapture before the millennial reign of Christ. So Christ, the idea is Christ is going to, a good portion of the righteous will be raptured, then Christ is going to come, he's going to be on his throne, he's going to reign for a thousand years, that's what the word millennial means, 1,000 years, upon a physical throne, that there's going to be this great battle with Christ, literally at the head of his army, against Satan and his army, and the battle is going to be a literal battle it's going to have guns and it's going to have tanks, and when you have some of these speculative theorists with regard to how it's going to go about, they'll put the pawns on the battle, that game that you put, world domination, what, Risk, yeah, the game Risk, and you've got all of the different countries on, and you put your pieces on it, and of course that's what generals do as well as they go through the process of their theater in war. And, okay, what's all of this going to happen? Who's going to ally with who? And I've got to just give you an example. A, um, a magazine. It's not a magazine, but a, which you can order out of, from a place called Kingdom Tapes. We used to get our tapes from there when we were using a tape duplicator. And he was selling packages to the Jews so that the Jews would have information and help when we're all raptured, because no one will be there to talk to them, so they need to have that information. He was, and he's been doing that for a long time. The head of this company is using the monies that are taken from primarily, I think, contributions in this case, but asking for monies for that purpose, because we want to be on the side of the Jews when this great battle happens. We don't want to be on the other side. Herbert Armstrong was talking when his theories were popular way back in the 70s with the idea that that Russia or the Soviet Union, Gog and Magog, these invaders from the north, and they were going to be opposed to the powers. And where were we going to be? And his view, if I remember correctly, basically is that we kind of supplant the Jews as God's chosen people. America does, and we're going to be fighting the battle with the Lord. So all of this kind of stuff happens, and these kinds of theories come up with regard to this battle of Armageddon. And so we want to talk a little bit about the battle, because in fact, when you look at that word that's found in the 16th verse, they gathered together the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. That's the only time that that word is used in the entire book. And in fact, the entire Bible, as far as I understand, there's no other place in the New Testament or Old Testament where Armageddon is used. So while some people might think, because of all that's said about it, that it must be one of the great themes of Scripture, well, in fact, the word is used once, and the fight or the battle is described several times in Revelation, but it's not what people think it is today. So let's talk a little bit about that. But before we do, with regard to River Euphrates, the kings from the east, the unclean spirits, the dragon beast, false prophet, anything anyone wants to add, any questions that you have before a discussion of Armageddon? Yes?
I would say it fascinates me.
Yeah, the conflict has already happened, yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
And I did want to point out, that's a very good point to make. I did want to make note, I got sidetracked obviously in my discussion, but the point that I was making earlier is that the evangelicals, they get a lot of play, and there are a number of reasons why. When I talk about the Southern Baptists and then the non-denominational churches and the TV preachers, so they get a lot of play primarily because they're on television. Most of the mainline denominations, and you're talking about the Catholics and the Methodists and the Protestants and the Presbyterians and the Lutherans and those kinds, they have premillennialists in their fellowship, but by and large, they are not premillennialists as a group. So the interesting thing that I see is with regard to, for example, how politics present Christians and how the secular society depicts Christians, it's almost like there is a monolithic wall that is erected, and on this wall is that there's this great conflict that is coming called the apocalypse, and it hasn't happened yet, and every Christian believes it. Christians believe, you go on the History Channel, anytime you have anything in the History Channel that's talking about the Bible, it's always Christians believe, as if you can lump us all into one big group that the world calls Christian and that we're all have unanimity. I don't believe most of what most people who call themselves Christians believe. In fact, I would oppose that very strongly. So the premillennial doctrine is something that is relatively new as a cohesive philosophy of how the world ends and how it all happens is something that has gained ascendancy, first of all, because of Jehovah's Witnesses and other cult-like groups, but it became more prevalent among the evangelical Christians. They're the ones that are going to go out. Most of these other denominations, if you're not a Methodist, then they're not going to try to recruit you to become a Methodist. If you're not a Catholic, they're not going to try to recruit you to be a Catholic. But the evangelicals, which means we go out and evangelize, we want to share our message. Well, if premillennialism is a part of that message, it gets out there. And that's why the world has the perception of it that they do. Premillennialism is characterized by speculative attempts to describe in a literal way what's going to happen by using this language that's found in Revelation. In other words, when we talk about the thousand-year reign that we'll talk about when we get to the 20th chapter of Revelation, that thousand-year reign is a literal thousand years that Jesus is going to reign on the earth, not taking into consideration that the Bible teaches clearly that Jesus is already reigning and that his reign is not on earth but rather in heaven. So these kinds of things are here, and that's why when you look at Armageddon, people get confused, and people are interested certainly in what it teaches, what it means, but they're way off with regard to it. So let's talk a little bit about the word Armageddon. The word itself means Hill of Megiddo. Hill of Megiddo. Megiddo was actually located as a city in the Valley of Jezreel. I don't have a map put up, probably should have got one, but it's basically, you know where Sea of Galilee is and where Mount Carmel is. So it's basically southwest of the Sea of Galilee and east of Mount Carmel. There's a valley there. It's called the Valley of Jezreel. And the town of Megiddo is located there in that valley. It's not the only town in the valley, but it is, of course, the root of this phrase Armageddon. It is in, basically, a valley. Keep that in mind as we continue talking. Notice a text from Judges 1. If you want to go with me there, it's Judges chapter 1 and verse 27. Judges 1 and verse 27. We are told there that Manasseh, one of the tribes of the Israelites, did not drive out the inhabitants of Bethshean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Iblim and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. I guess perhaps more a province or an area rather than a single place. But there is Megiddo and its villages. And the Canaanites were determined to dwell in the land. We talked a little bit about how they should have wiped them out completely. Well, they didn't. And so not all the inhabitants of Megiddo were wiped out. The Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land, in that area. There's a number of references to Megiddo that we find in the Old Testament. But again, when we talk about here, we talk about the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, this province. There's a reference in Judges 5:19 to the waters of Megiddo. So that would have reference to any springs and rivers or creeks or brooks that are in that region of Megiddo. There is the Valley of Megiddo. It's in the Valley of Jezreel, the portion of that valley that is in that province of Megiddo and its villages. Well, that would be referred to as the Valley of Megiddo, and it is referred to that in 2 Chronicles 35 and verse 22. When you go again from the book of Genesis to the book of Revelation, there is no reference save in the derivation of the term Armageddon. There is no reference to the Mount of Megiddo. So understand this, the Battle of Armageddon, where will it take place? It will take place in this valley of Jezreel that is mentioned. And Armageddon means the Hill of Megiddo, but there is no Hill of Megiddo in the Valley of Jezreel. It's not a geographical place. It's not a geographical real location. In other words, there's not a mountain there that is named or ever has been named Megiddo. So just another example as to why this might possibly not have reference to a literal location or a literal battle, since the actual location that is mentioned in the name is absolutely non-existent. But this Valley of Jezreel is an area that held a lot of significance. to the Jews. There are a number of occasions in the Old Testament, and I think this is where the significance lies. For example, Barak and Deborah, in their battle against the kings of Canaan, they overthrew the kings of Canaan, as recorded in Judges chapter 5, in that valley of Jezreel. That's where that battle was located. Also, Gideon, when he defeated the Midianites in Judges chapter 6, it was there. There were also losses. Saul was defeated by the Philistines, as 1 Samuel chapter 31 indicates to us, there. And Josiah, the last king of Judah, or at least the last sovereign king of Judah, was defeated by Pharaoh Necho there in the valley of Jezreel, as indicated in 2 Kings chapter 23. So when you look at the Bible and you want to find a place of significant battles that were war, where there were battles against the people of God, and especially if you were to take the idea that these battles were where there was a defeat in its prime, where there was victory for the Jews and defeat of the opponents in its prime, and then of course later we've got the defeat during the decline of Judah. That place of significant battles, it would be an obvious place to put this battle between good and evil, this spiritual battle, in the language of the book of Revelation. And so again, we note that there is significance about the location, but if we're looking for a literal correlation in the name, Hill of Megiddo, it's not there. It's not found there. The Battle of Armageddon is spoken often of in theology, as we said, but there's only one place where the word is used, and then the battle is described. It's alluded to in other chapters that we've already read, but I want to just go very quickly over to chapter 19 and read verses 19 through 21 so that we will see the Battle of Armageddon described just very succinctly in verses 19 through 21 of Revelation chapter 19. So this battle being fought, I saw the beast, the king of the earth and their armies, gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. And the beast was taken, with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And these two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. And the rest were killed with a sword which proceeded out of the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. So that's the culmination of that battle, which leads to the setting of that victor upon his 1,000-year reign on his throne, as in chapter 20 indicates immediately following. So there is the battle as it is described in the 19th chapter. And again, allusions that we talked about to the battle up, and of course there are other visions and other parts of the chastisements with regard to the trumpets that are also attributed and descriptions that are given, things taken out of context, trying to get all this together. So, we've already alluded to the false view of the battle. I've got it now here in my list of notes. So I just want to note that the view of premillennialists is it's a literal physical battle yet to happen with modern weapons of war, typically. They talk about tanks and planes and bombs and all of those kinds of things, happening right before a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on the physical throne of Israel. So their view is, again, that all that's happening here and being spoken of here is yet future, which is why they're speculating, wondering which country is going to take part, what's the strategy going to be, how is it going to be like, all of those kinds of things, trying to put a literal parallel to the symbolic language that is used in this particular text. And it's problematic, as we've seen in our discussion all the way up to this point, for a couple of reasons. The primary two, which we have sought to be consistent with regard to our establishment and following of these principles, is number one, is that these are things that must shortly come to pass, and that would not give comfort to those who were living in the first century if they haven't happened even yet. Again, the premillennialists typically say we're the generation where it's going to happen. They've been saying that for about three or four generations, at least in United States history, but that's the view that many hold. And then secondly, is the language of the apocalypse is apocalyptic language, which is as its base, metaphorical, symbolical. It is a series of pictures and these hyperbolous descriptions that are used in our mind's eye, get us to understand just how great this conflict is between good and evil, between God and Satan, and between the oppressors of God's people, the spiritual oppressors and physical oppressors of God's people on the earth. And so it doesn't segue into a literal battle. But as a result of that, they say, okay, well, when did it happen and where did it happen and what's the proof of it? See, they're looking for the literal still on that, aren't they? We're looking for an actual literal battle that you can go to that happened in the Valley of Jezreel that signified either the end of Jerusalem or the end of the Roman Empire, and you can look at it and say, there it is, and that's why we know that that's what it's talking about. But what we do know is that there was a spiritual battle fought, Jerusalem fell, because God had ordained the destruction of Jerusalem, as indicated in the 24th chapter of Matthew. And there was a literal battle that was, or a spiritual battle that was fought against the Roman Empire, and the empire fell too, because God judged that empire and that nation, as Daniel chapter 2 said he would. And so we're not looking for a literal fulfillment. We're looking at the symbology of the text and understanding that at the end, notice again in reading verses 19 through 21 of chapter 19, if you look at verse 20, the rest were killed with the sword which proceeded out of the mouth of him who sat on the horse, Christ the victor, with the Stephanos crown on his horse, with that great sword, being victorious over the devil and his armies and his minions, over the beast and over the false prophet, and over all that would oppress the people of God. That's what happened, and that's what this battle is talking about. It is a spiritual battle against the forces of evil, the devil and his acolytes, and God and his saints. The evil spirits depicted as frogs. It's seen in the lack of a literal geological location for the battle, and it has been already fought. There are two passages I want to leave you with before we go on into new material, which again, I think, in plain prose, from the book of John and 2 Corinthians, starting in John chapter 18, establishes that the fanciful view of the premillennialists concerning the battle of Armageddon cannot be so. In John 18, in verse 36, Pilate had talked to John. Talked to Jesus there in that text. I'd like to go back there and just note specifically. I don't have it all in my notes. So in verse 36 and 37, we have the conversation that Jesus has with Pontius Pilate. And so in verse 33, Pilate entered the praetorium, said to Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered, "Are you speaking for yourself, or did others tell you this about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priest have delivered you to me. So are you the king of the Jews?" And of course, Jesus did affirm that he was. But he knew that Pilate didn't have any understanding of what was going on. Well, the idea of Jesus being the king of the Jews was absolutely ridiculous to Pilate, because it was the Jews who delivered him up to Pilate. How can you be a king of a nation who's wanting your death? And notice his response there in verse 36. Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight." That's a literal battle that's under consideration there. That's a little literal war that we're talking about. In other words, a physical war upon the earth. "If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I would not be delivered to the Jews." Jesus is saying, "I'm here alone. Do you see any of my followers coming with knives and swords in an attempt to get me out of here so that I can ascend to the throne of Israel?" That's not what's happening here. So Pilate asked him again, "Are you a king then?" And Jesus said, "You have rightly said, I am a king. For this cause I was born, for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth, and everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Jesus is a king, but his kingdom is not of this world. That's one of the primary divisors of Scripture when you're talking about the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. The Old Covenant, the Jews were a physical kingdom in physical Canaan with a physical king upon a physical throne. And then you've got the New Covenant, where Jesus is a spiritual king of all who are spiritual Jews living on or reigning on a spiritual throne. And rather than being a kingdom that would come to an end as the Jewish kingdom did, Jesus' kingdom will never come to end and will break into pieces all the other kingdoms because of its spiritual nature, because there will be those of every nation under heaven that will leave that idea. And this is, if there's any ever an argument for the Christian against nationalism, it's this. You're first a citizen of Christ's kingdom. Doesn't matter what nation you're a part of. Doesn't matter what your citizenship is. Your king is Christ Jesus. That's his kingdom. And that's what's described in John 18, which I think is a wonderful commentary to utilize to have a better understanding of what this battle actually is and the significance of it. One other passage I wanted to make note of in 2 Corinthians 10, then I'll open it up to you. Any questions or comments you might have. 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 6. The Apostle Paul says that though we, now we're citizens in the kingdom, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. And so it's a spiritual battle that we fight as citizens in the kingdom. It's a spiritual battle that's being fought, and a judgment that's being visited upon the ungodly in the book of Revelation. And we should not try to correlate that or be concerned when individuals become so speculative as to what's going to happen in the Battle of Armageddon in the Valley of Jezreel. Okay? Comments, questions? Good enough? It's going to get harder in chapter 17. I've read ahead a little bit, and it's going to get harder. Okay, so keeping that in mind, what is our responsibility as Christian soldiers? Well, we could go to Ephesians 6, put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to fight against the wiles of the devil, and having fought, above all, being able to stand. And then also in 1 Peter chapter 5, in verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. Okay? Yes? Remember that these things are things that have already happened in that regard. So when we're talking about the Battle of Armageddon as an event, this was God's judgment upon the evil oppressors that were troubling the Christians in the first century. So again, as we've talked about, and Dennis has on occasion made a few points to bolster his view that the events of, or the writing was prior to AD 70, and the events of Revelation deal with the fall of Jerusalem. Well, the Battle of Armageddon would result in the destruction of the Great Babylon, which would be Jerusalem, and that happened in AD 70. With regard to the Roman Empire, it is something that happened beyond the first century, and that the Roman Empire would be the one that would be under consideration in this particular text. With regard to the thousand-year reign, we'll talk about that in more detail, but understand again that we're not talking about a literal thing. And there are a lot of different millennialisms. There's premillennial, there's postmillennialism, there is amillennialism. And the amillennialism is what you and I would be considered by those who like to put millennialisms on every single point of view, typically. And that would be the idea that it is a spiritual reign, and then we're in the midst of that reign, and it's not a thousand years. And we'll flesh that out. We'll talk a little bit more about that. There are problems with the amillennial view, to be honest. One of the problems has to do with the idea that, again, surrounds it, that this thousand-year reign that's found in Revelation chapter 20 is a period of time of great progress, great peace, great gentility, all of these kinds of things in the description that's given. So an amillennialist will take the text of Revelation chapter 20 and try to, again, physically characterize the age in which we live as being the proper way of looking at the particular text. But they try to take, again, the symbolic and make it literal. That's why I would not address myself as an amillennialist, even though others would put me in that category. Alexander Campbell, as an example, was an amillennialist. The first, he called his first paper that he edited, the Christian Baptist. And then he put out a second paper a little bit later on, after he had basically separated himself from denominationalism entirely and was writing a great deal to try to justify his actions. And it was called The Millennial Harbinger. Okay, so the word millennial is the same thing, 1,000 years. The harbinger means a bringing in. The bringing in of the 1,000 years. And Alexander Campbell had the view that we are living now in the 1,000-year reign, and this is a time, and he again thought in his generation, because again he was moving away from denominationalism, and now we're back to the true church. In my lifetime, we're going to evangelize the world. That's the view that he had. And it's going to be so wonderful, it's going to change society entirely. Well, after a period of time, 10, 20, 30 years, everything's kind of much the same. There weren't a lot of changes. And that's why Alexander Campbell said, the church as we're doing it now and evangelizing the world, it's not working, so we need to establish the American Christian Missionary Society, and all the churches will send their money to the Missionary Society, and the Missionary Society will send all of the evangelists out to evangelize the world, because we can do it more logically, more systemically in that regard, and make sure that it's all covered, and this will work better. And so they established the American Missionary Society, which was one of the primary reasons why there was a division among God's people in the late 1800s, that and instrumental music. So that was his view. Well, what was his view? His view was based upon a literal understanding of the Revelation text and what this 1,000-year reign of Christ would indicate, of which he thought he was a part. And because of that, he became disenchanted with the God's pattern, because he wasn't getting the results that he thought he should get, instead of understanding that evil exists in the world today and will, and there'll be these constant conflicts, and we're having our own. But the key always is to usher in the kingdom of God through the proclamation of the gospel, and those who are receptive to the gospel become citizens. That's our plan, and we do it God's ways rather than man's ways. So again, amillennialism has its problems as well, and I don't want to be categorized in that way. But having said that, the idea or view that God, Christ is reigning on his throne right now, and he will reign on his throne for a good long time, which we could signify by the word number 1,000, which is a big number, then that would rightly describe what I believe, that he's sitting on his throne, has been since his ascension into heaven, and will be throughout eternity. All right? So a little out of, I appreciate that question. That's good, because it helps to kind of flesh out what we're talking about here. That was second veil, wasn't it? Okay, so next week, I thought we'd probably get through, but we're not quite there. But you'll notice up on the board, we've got 5 more that we'll talk about. And those are not nearly as extensive as what we've talked about up to this point. So we will have to finish up, get into chapter 17. And brethren, if you've not been doing it yet, because I always try to encourage you, read chapter 17 a number of different times. So that at least, even if you don't understand what's being talked about and what it all means, at least you'll have familiarity with the symbols and such, so that we can discuss it in a better way than we might otherwise be able to. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today.